Turn to the book of Luke, chapter 23. Book of Luke, chapter 23. Before we announce our text, I'd just give some background leading up to what we have here. On the evening of the Passover, Jesus, of course, was betrayed and arrested, according to John chapter 18, verses 13 and 14. He was then bound and led away to Annas. In Matthew 26 and verse 57. And there the scribes and the elders were assembled. From there he was led away to Caiaphas. Caiaphas began to question Jesus concerning the accusations against him. And it was there before Caiaphas that they determined that he was guilty of death. They spit upon him. They buffeted him. Smote him. Caiaphas and the council became enraged by the response of Christ. And the next morning, they led him away to Pilate, the governor. And this is where Luke chapter 23 picks up. They said to Pilate in verse 2, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Pilate then began to question Jesus and declared in verse 4, "I find no fault in this man." We see the response of the people in verse 5, and they were the more fierce, saying, "He stirreth up the people, teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place." Pilate then, of course, continued to question, and he soon discovered that Jesus belonged to the jurisdiction of Herod. As soon as he found that out, he sent him to Herod, who proceeded to question Christ, and he too found nothing worthy of death in him. Notice verse 11, "And Herod with his men of war set him at naught and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him again to Pilate." So now Jesus is before Pilate for the second time. And Pilate, in verse 13, called together the chief priests and the rulers of the people. And he said unto them, "Neither do I nor Herod find anything worthy of death in this man." Pilate, of course, wanting to set Christ free, but also not wanting to compromise himself in the eyes of his superiors, he makes reference to a custom that was their regular practice, the custom of releasing a prisoner during the Passover. And since some prisoner must be released and set free, Pilate thinks, "This is my opportunity of allowing the innocent Christ to go free." So he offers to chastise Christ and set him free, and then crucify Barabbas, who was one of the most notorious of all their criminals. But the people in unison cry out in verse 18, "Away with this man," that is Jesus, "and release unto us Barabbas," that is, crucify Christ, set free Barabbas. Pilate could not believe what he was hearing, so he made the offer the second time in verse 20. Pilate, therefore, willing to release Jesus, spake again to them. And then we see their response, "But they cried, saying, crucify him, crucify him." Pilate then, for the third time, declared the innocence of Christ. And the response of the people is recorded in verse 23. "And they were instant with loud voices, requiring that he might be crucified. And the voices of them and of the chief priests prevailed." At this time, according to Matthew's account, Matthew 27, verse 26, Pilate scourged Jesus and delivered him to be crucified. And we see in Matthew 27, verse 27 through 31, those events. Luke says in verse 26, and when they led him away, and they arrive at the place of the crucifixion, and Christ is crucified. And for our text, we'll read verse 48. And all the people that came together to that sight, beholding the things which were done, smote their breasts and returned. The people here, what we have here is the record, the feeling of horror that came upon the people that had witnessed the crucifixion, had witnessed the suffering of Christ. They had witnessed the thick darkness, and horror came upon them. After witnessing such, they went to their silent groups. And we want to take the thought of the message today from verse 48, and all the people that came together to that sight, or to that place. Many had gathered. Many had gathered at that sight, most out of furious malice, and some, I'm sure, gathered out of mere curiosity. We read in Matthew 27, verse 36, that some of them that had gathered watched him there. They sat down and watched him there. We read in Matthew 27 and verse 39 that some passed by. We read in verse 49 of Luke chapter 23, some stood afar off, beholding these things. But they had all gathered to that sight. And by way of our imaginations and by way of faith, we want to take a trip to that sight. And when they had all gathered to that sight, I want to speak this morning on the sight of the crucifixion. We need to go there every now and then, and we need to behold what took place at that site. We see in Luke 23 that they led him away to this place, and we read in our text, and all the people came together to that site. That site was a place called Golgotha. Very specific place. We read in Matthew 27 and verse 33, and when they were come into a place called Golgotha, that is to say, the place of a skull. Mark writes in Mark 15, verse 22, and they bring him unto the place of Golgotha, which is being interpreted the place of the skull. John wrote in John 19 and verse 17, and he, that would be Simon, bearing his cross, went forth into a place called the place of the skull, which is the Hebrew Golgotha. And Luke writes in Luke 23 and verse 33, and when they were come to the place, which is called Calvary, which of course is Latin for Golgotha. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all mention this place, this site, by name. The place called Golgotha, or the place called Calvary. It was not a large place. In fact, it was a small, elevated, rocky knoll. And we learn from Hebrews 13 and verse 12 that it was outside of the city, or outside of the walls of Jerusalem. We also gather from John 19, verses 41 and 42, that there was a burial ground nearby. This place called Golgotha or Calvary was the place where the Romans put guilty criminals to death by crucifixion. It was a place where guilty criminals met their gruesome fate. Thousands and thousands of times, the Romans would parade the guilty out of the city to this place, to this site called Golgotha or Calvary. And no doubt many of those who walked that road to that place pleaded for their lives. Some of them on their way to that place, I'm sure they claimed their innocence all the way. There were others who probably cursed their accusers. But oh, what a trip it was for thousands and thousands to that site. And if you would observe those who had traveled that road before, I'm sure if you would look upon their faces, you would see dread and you would see absolute fear. But looking in on this occasion, there is Jesus. His head is embedded with a crown of thorns. The flesh of his back has been torn to shreds. The muscles and tissues have been lacerated by the scourging. His face is bloodied and bruised. And also upon that face is the dried spittle of sinful man. And he's being mocked. As he's traveling that road, he's being mocked. And the crowd is making their way to Golgotha, or Calvary. There are no doubt people in front of him clearing the way. There are no doubt people beside him. There are no doubt people behind him. The people are anxious. The people are anxious for Jesus to be crucified. And to speed up the process, they force a man by the name of Simon to carry the cross which Jesus would be crucified. Looking upon Jesus at this time, he's so different than all the others who have ever walked this road. There is no sign of dread. There is no sign of fear in his expressions. There is no sign of fear in his movements. He is not fighting with his accusers. He is not trying to resist his accusers. Never has one been more innocent that has walked this road. Yet, he is not pleading his innocence, nor is he pleading for his life. And unlike so many others who have walked this road, he's not cursing his accusers. So we need to behold him on his way to this place, on his way to this site. And we read in verse 33, "And when they were come to the place, which is called Calvary," or Latin for Golgotha. So they eventually arrive at the place where the demands and the consequences of a broken law were carried out by the Romans. They arrive at that place where final judgment was carried out upon the very worst of men. It is a site of ultimate punishment, a designated site, a designated place of suffering and torture and pain, a designated place of misery and sorrow and heartbreak, designated place of execution, a designated place of condemnation, the site of agonizing death. And many had gone before. So they arrive at this place of great humiliation, great indignity, and disgrace. As they arrive at this place, the cross is taken off from Simon. The cross would then be laid upon the ground, and Jesus would be thrust to the ground, and he would be nailed to the cross. And then, of course, that cross is lifted from the ground. The ligaments and bones of the wrist supporting the entire weight of the body, which, of course, would have been excruciating. And the cross is then thrust into the ground, which would cause all the bones to come out of joint. And we need to behold him there. Behold him there. But as we come to this site, we notice a massive crowd of people. But you also notice on this particular day, there were three crosses. It appears that upon those crosses are three condemned criminals who deserve to die. That's what it would appear. As you face these three crosses, there's one on the left, there's one on the right, and on those two crosses are the usual criminals. There's also a cross in the middle. And on this day, everyone's attention is focused upon that middle cross. And if you were just passing by that day, you would not help but notice that the one upon that center cross is far more despised and hated than the ones on the other two crosses. He's far more shunned by the people than the guilty thieves upon the other two crosses. It seems like all the mocking and the taunting and the ridicule is directed toward the one upon that center cross. If you were to listen in, you would hear some saying, "He saved others." And oh, how true. Himself he cannot save. That also was true. He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now, if he'll have him. There's more scorn. There's more disgust. There's more hostility and animosity shown toward that one upon the center cross than the selfish thief over here and the selfish thief over here. By walking, people walking by, looking upon that central cross, they shake their heads in disgust. Said they wagged their heads. The one upon that center cross, without a doubt, was considered by the people to be far worse than the one on the right and the one on the left. Not only were those who were sitting and standing there and passing by showing their utter disdain toward the one upon that center cross, but the thieves, they also were doing the same thing. They also were taunting and mocking the one upon that center cross. And if you look upon the one on the center cross, he has far more bruises than the thieves on the other two crosses. His body is far more mangled than the other two thieves. His suffering is so much more intense than the others. And if you look upon this one on the center cross, his head is embedded with a crown of thorns. And the blood has run down his face from such. His body is mutilated and mangled. The large Roman spikes have been driven through his hands and his feet. And his bones are out of socket. His back has been pulverized by the scourging. There's bruises all over his face. So much so that he does not even look like a human being, according to Isaiah 52. And upon his face again is the dried spittle of man. In the history of the world, there has never been a scene in which so much unrestrained derision and contempt were so unanimously poured upon one man as at this sight, at that day. We need to stop and behold the one upon that center cross. We need to just stand there, and in our imaginations, and most more importantly by faith, see him there. And as you gaze upon the one in that center cross, you cannot help but notice that the inscription upon that cross is quite different. It is not the usual inscription, thief or murderer. But it reads, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." On the right, there is the inscription, thief or murderer. On the left, you have the same inscription. But upon this center cross, it's not thief. It's not murder. It's, "This is Jesus, King of the Jews." And you need to stop, and you need to behold that one. He is despised. He is rejected. According to Isaiah 53, he's stricken, he's smitten, he's afflicted, he's wounded, he's bruised, he's chastised, and he's in travail of soul. But let the words of the inscription sink deep into our hearts. This is Jesus. This is Jesus. The Almighty, the Eternal, the omnipotent, omniscient, all-sufficient God, in a body of human flesh, upon a cross. This is Jesus. Some in that crowd might say, "Isn't he the one who healed the blind? Isn't he the one who healed the sick and gave hearing to the deaf? Isn't he the one who cast out demons? Isn't he the one who even raised some from death to life?" Yeah, that's him. This is Jesus. And there he is. He's in a place of suffering. He's in a place of torture. He's in a place of misery. He's in a place of death. But oh, that the inscription of that cross would get a hold of us. This is Jesus. This is Jesus. And as you look upon that central cross, remember, he's God. He's God in a fleshly body. He's perfectly pure. He's holy. He's harmless. He's undefiled. He is without fault. He is sinless. And He is innocent. And there He is. In this place, where the most violent and the most dishonest of men were brought. There He is, where the most filthy, where the most wicked, foul, and vile, and repulsive of mankind has been brought to face the consequences of their crimes. But He has done no wrong. Yet He's dying the death of a criminal. He's not only dying the death of a criminal, He is being treated as if He were the worst of all criminals that ever lived. We need to behold Him there upon that cross. And as you behold Him there upon that center cross, remember this. He is there voluntarily, and He is there willingly. Upon the other two crosses, they were there because they committed a crime. Why was the one on the left there? Because he committed a crime. Why was the one on the right there? He committed a crime. Why is this one in the center? Why is he there? Because he wants to be. Because he wants to be. People did not want to go. People did not willingly go to this place. That is why he was offered vinegar on the way and he refused it. It was to relieve them of pain, but it was also to help the soldiers so that they wouldn't resist, so the prisoner wouldn't resist. But this man offered no resistance. He went willingly. He is there because he wanted to. This is Jesus. And the reason he is there is because he wants to be. We need to behold him there. As you look upon that center cross, remember why he's there. Looking at the cross on the left or looking at the cross on the right, you immediately know why they're there. The inscription tells us why they're there. But looking upon the inscription on the center cross, this is Jesus, the King of the Jews. The passerby who, hard to believe that there were any, but perhaps a passerby who was ignorant of the whole situation might ask, well, why is he there? I know why the other two are there, it says so, but why is he there? Why is he in this place of anguish? And the answer is, he's there as God's offering. He's there as God's offering. He's there out of love for others. Can't say that about the other two. He's there in the place of others. Oh, he's done no wrong. But he's there because he wants to be. And he's there in the place of others. He's in that place for me. And Jesus, though he did no sin, though he was without sin, though he had broken no law, there he is. Dying the death of the worst criminal. And he's doing that because He wants to. He's doing that for me. He's doing that in my place. The reason that this one named Jesus is in this place, dying upon a cross, is because He took upon Himself every single one of my sins. All the vileness of those sins, all the filth of those sins, all the guilt of those sins, all the debt that is involved in those sins, the entire load was upon Him. And He voluntarily, willingly, and on purpose went to this place for me. And in my place. And for me, and in my place, He was made a curse and considered to be the worst of criminals. Jesus, with my sin, went voluntarily and willingly and on purpose, with a heart of love, to this place for me. And there at this place, He would endure unimaginable. You and I cannot begin to imagine, because you would have to be perfectly holy. This is holiness with sin laid upon Him. We cannot grasp that. There He is in this unimaginable distress, and pain, and misery, and sorrow, and anguish and torment. As you look at Him there, you can see outwardly He's wounded and He's bruised. And you can see outwardly He's being punished. He's been lacerated. But you cannot see the anguish of His soul. That no one can see. That is between Him and God. But there He is, suffering the wrath of God in my place. Now, I do believe at the cross the Romans did a work. I believe Satan did a work. But that's not what paid for our sins. God did a work. God poured His wrath upon His Son. Poured His wrath upon our sins that were upon His sons. In other words, Christ received what our sins deserved at the hand of God. He's laying down His life for His enemies, paying a debt that they could not pay. It's the Lord of Lords stooping to unheard of depths for you and I. This is a love. I mean, if you go to this place, they came together to that sight. At that sight is a love beyond amazing. It is a love that you and I do not fully understand. But as we behold Him there, if we could physically go to that place on that day, we don't have to, because we can go there by faith. But as you go to that place, and as you behold, and as you read the inscription, "This is Jesus," and you know why He's there, what do you feel? What do you feel? Do you feel an attraction to Him? Do you feel your heart being drawn to this one? As you look upon Him, what do you see? Do you see a beauty that is beyond compare? As you look upon him, what does he mean to you? What influence does he have upon your life? As you look upon him, do you consider him worthy? Consider who he's there for. Do you consider him worthy to live for? Worthy to die for? Worthy to glorify him in your life? Beholding him there, can we be indifferent? Can we be indifferent toward him? Knowing why he's there? Knowing he's there for me? Can I be indifferent? Can I be can I show no concern for him? Can we be untouched as we behold him there? Can we be unfeeling or detached as we come to this site? We need to go there. We understand the story doesn't end there. We understand that. We understand that he would be put in a grave and 3 days and 3 nights later he would come victorious out of that grave. And it doesn't end there either. He would ascend back into heaven and sit at the right hand of God. So we understand that it doesn't end here. But we do need to go to this place. We do need to revisit this place from time to time. And realize what Jesus has done. Realize the price that has been paid for our souls. If you love him today, and I believe most here do, love him more. Love him more. How can you go to this place and not love him more? If you think highly of him today, go to this place and think even more highly of him. If you serve him today, go to this place. Look at him. Behold him. Meditate upon what happened. And serve him more. If you're close to him today, visit this place. And draw even closer. If you have a zeal for him, go to this place and be even more zealous for him. Be even more surrendered to him. Again, we read those words, and the people came together to that site. Notice verse 49. This talks about those who loved him. And all his acquaintance and the women that followed him from Galilee stood afar off. But notice what it says. Beholding. Beholding. These things. We need to spend some time at this site. And we need to behold him there. Behold what took place at the cross. All through the Old Testament, we have pictures, word pictures drawn for us concerning the crucifixion. No picture, no word picture can do justice to what happened that day. And I believe, you can believe what you want, but you remember Jesus spoke seven times from that cross. One of the times, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And on the day of Pentecost, over 3,000 were saved. And I believe that was the answer to Jesus' prayer, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Many who beheld him that day were saved. Just a little while later, it had a great effect upon them. Something is wrong with us if we can go to the cross and it not have an effect upon us. Brother Larry, if you'd come and lead us in verse song.